President of the United States on his determined policy of de-escalating the war in Vietnam, of disengagement, of Vietnamization, as he chose to call it. And as I look back upon that, which was almost 14 months ago now when I made that announcement, I see no reason to change that position. I think the president's policy of disengaging the United States in that part in South Vietnam has made measurable headway. It's slow and it's painful, but the key to it is it's responsible. And I think it's responsible disengagement that separates the president's withdrawal from the irresponsible demands that we somehow pull this thing off overnight. I think the consequences of that would create a very serious scar on us.
I recall it's been about 2 years ago, the last time I interviewed you on Free for All. We talked a little bit about the domino theory.
Yes.
In Southeast Asia, and in talking with some people yesterday about this, some of them really don't understand what this theory is. So would you explain what that is and your beliefs along the lines of the domino theory?
Yes, the domino theory in Southeast Asia simply says that here is a collection of small, independent, new and fragile countries, and that if as they're trying to grow up and learn the art of self-government, they're prey to acts of violence, such as attacks from the outside, and that if one of them is shattered from the outside, they all then are shattered because of the delicate and fragile nature of their own governments. And thus, if Vietnam were to be knocked down by an attack from, let's say, the north, the consequences for all of the surrounding areas would be very serious. Their governments would either fall because of their weakness to begin with, due to the fact that they're very new, or they would be likely targets for a similar attack, which they could not defend themselves against very successfully, at least for several years. They're begging for time. They need time to grow up and to stabilize, which time has already been won for them in the last 5 or 6 years. They're quite a different group of small countries now than just 5 years ago. But the domino theory was that if you destroyed one of them by an act of violence from the outside, that the others would find it very difficult, perhaps impossible, to survive the impact of it.
Lately, of course, the big news has been Cambodia. The president, of course, pulled the troops out last, I think it was last Tuesday, the 30th, or had them out by the deadline. And there's the Cooper Church Amendment, which would cut off funds to Cambodia, which you voted against.
That's right.
What is your stand with the invasion of Cambodia, which is now, of course, over with?
Well, the whole Cambodian move was, from the very first, very much open to question. That is, this was one of those things that you were taking a great chance on. It was the president's final judgment, and only he could make that judgment as commander-in-chief, that the chance, the risk, had to be taken because of other risks if you didn't move. And that's the reason that I supported the president in the move. But nobody was blind to the great risks that were involved. And in the short run, I think the president's risk-taking has paid off in short-term military, as a military operation. What its consequences may be in the long run, we don't know yet. This is still being measured and has not yet run its course. And I'm sure the president would know, or the chiefs of staff would know. Certainly we don't know. And so all of us would suspend judgment on the long-term consequences. But in the short run, I think the president made it stick as a justifiable risk to try to avoid something worse if no move was made, namely in denying the sanctuary free to an enemy that was using it to impede and perhaps to prolong the American withdrawal.
Do we, or, well, obviously, let me change the question. Did we have, back in 60, 61, when we started becoming involved in Vietnam, did we really have a commitment to the nations in Southeast Asia?
We had no formal commitment except to CETO, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. That did not include all of the new countries or governments in Southeast Asia. The basis for the American policy position that was first sketched out by President Truman and then augmented by President Eisenhower and followed through on by Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and now President Nixon was that it was Southeast Asia that really had gotten us into the War of the Pacific. Pearl Harbor was the only thing that involved us in the War of the Pacific. And the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor for just one reason, and that was to seize Southeast Asia. The American fleet was the only force standing between them and that part of the world. And because of the way we got involved in the war, World War II, there was very strong conviction among our leaders, regardless of party, that Southeast Asia had made a difference and still made a difference to the chances for some kind of longer interval of peace in that part of the world, and thus peace for the United States.
There have been many, many issues which come to mind over the past years. One of the controversial issues of recent years was gun control legislation. And I, amidst all the news releases and the turmoil about gun control, which side of the fence were you on about gun control legislation?
I've always been on one side of the fence on gun control, and that is that I oppose any gun control legislation that ventured toward registration of guns or in any way seriously interfering with the freedom of sportsmen and people of responsibility to own and use their guns. We all try to be intelligent about necessary legislation to help to win the battle against crime in the streets. But my position there has been that we ought to increase the penalties for any crime committed with the use of a gun, rather than try to go at it through the back door of affecting the ownership of guns among legitimate sportsmen who are responsible in their use.
You had another sort of I shouldn't use the name of a product, but let's say maybe an Excedrin headache for a while, which was about the postal system. And a lot of people were saying Gail McGee and company of the Postal Committee can be blamed for this. This was something this during the last year. And how did that finally work itself out?
Well, first of all, that charge was never made except from the offices of one political party only in the state of Wyoming, never anywhere else in the United States, and least of all in Washington. The president, the postmaster general, all of those involved on the union side in averting the postal strike have made it clear on the public record that the Senate committee was the honest broker that brought them together and made it possible to achieve a settlement in the postal impasse. But for the understandable reasons that I suppose one would say is the name of the game, there were those trying to make political capital out of it only in Wyoming, largely because it's the first time they'd ever had a chairman of a committee west of the Mississippi River. And and that's fun and games in a political year, I guess we'd have to say. But it's turned out very well. There was no postal strike. There was a wildcat strike. The postal unions never authorized one. The walkouts were illegal ones and unsanctioned ones. And we got them back together. They negotiated a meaningful labor management collective bargaining agreement And it's the measure that's included in the bill that has just passed the Senate, the McGee-Fong Postal Reform Bill, that accepts the Postmaster General's agreement with the postal unions as a new piece of landmark legislation.
We'll continue with Free for All and our guest, Senator Gail McGee, in just a moment. Well, it's kind of like the Johnny Carson show sometimes, Senator. We have to stop and get our commercial sponsors in that make this all possible. I felt like perhaps I interrupted you on the postal question.
Just let me top that off by saying that the Senate bill that was passed through the Senate 76-10 and is now going to conference with the House when I return tomorrow, tightens the Postal Service, takes it completely out of politics, and gives it long-term financing and reform, and sets it up as an independent agency of the government of the United States. And these are the long-awaited reforms. It is truly landmark legislation. And in the process, it was Senator Fong and I who personally stopped the president from increasing first-class mail rates along the way to 10 cents. We felt that the first-class mail users are already paying their own way. Those costs ought to be distributed in other places. And we were totally successful in blocking the president in that 10-cent stamp move.
What about the economic situation in the country? People have been concerned about this. We even spoke about this yesterday with Mike Sweeter, about the housewives all the way up and all the way whatever direction, this economic situation, and many people are very, very concerned. The Vice President Agnew spoke yesterday in Denver and said that we're in good shape. What about this?
Well, we're all very deeply concerned, and the White House, too. With all due respect to the Vice President, his statement had to be strained. The White House is burning a lot of midnight oil over the seriousness of the economic course of events in our country now. The inflationary spiral is a very serious one. My own view on it, my own recommendation on it, is that the president has great power as chief executive to cope with this question, that you often don't have time to wait for legislation, and you're guilty of aiding and abetting inflation if you pretend to await such legislative action. The president only needs to call in the heads of those elements in the economy that are involved most directly in the inflationary processes and bash a few of them together. Lyndon Johnson did this. Jack Kennedy did this before him. Harry Truman did it once immediately after the war. And you can get them to slow down. A president that's aggressive on this has tremendous power capabilities for doing so. If, for example, President Nixon had called in the Wall Street bankers the day that they prepared to raise the interest rates on this last big thrust in contradiction to government policies, I think there's little doubt but that they would have gotten the message had he been strong and firm. He only slapped their wrists after the fact without ever having them down to the White House and reading the Riot Act to them. And I think this is the thing that's missing in our present economic picture.
Go back to a moment before we start taking telephone calls to Vietnam. This is something that everyone talks about, is concerned about. Are we going to be there another 50 years? Does anybody know? And if so, do you think we ought to stay there another 50, 100 years?
Oh, there are those that are recklessly throwing words around like that. I, in my book, I argue that if we can work out a collective security peacekeeping pact like NATO in Europe, in Asia, this is what peacekeeping comes down to in this day and age, in which you include all the Asian governments and get them to take on a great measure of that responsibility. It's like a United Nations with teeth in it. If we're able to do that, that's the best hope for peace in the world. And that kind of a commitment, hopefully, would be for a very long time, because that would mean peace. And you're not going to get peace by hiding from the world. We've tried that before. And in trying to hide in the 1930s, we got Hitler, and we got war with Japan in the Pacific. And so the only hope in the world is to have a world effort through a collective security arrangement, an agreement like the UN, something on that order, something like NATO, to keep the peace in the troubled parts of the world. And the United States, as perhaps the most powerful country in the world, could never avoid those things. In fact, would have to be one of those rather directly involved. But that's the sort of chance for peace that I think most all Americans understand and would like to see us succeed at.
Do you find that in supporting President Nixon, a Republican, are you getting a lot of backlash, so to speak, from some of the Democratic supporters around the state?
Yes, we get some criticism like that. And then there are some people who think you ought to oppose a Republican president because you're a Democrat. But I hope that we've learned in our country that in the big issues of the world, there are no Democratic or Republican solutions. These questions and these problems are so much larger than a political party. Many of them are even larger than individual nations. And that you've got to work on a much higher level with a much stronger purpose than partisan politics. And I think the question of our foreign policy in Eastern Asia is one of those questions. And that's why in the 12 years that I've been in the Senate, that I have supported two Republican presidents and two Democratic presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon, on their foreign policies in that part of the world. I happen to think that they have come closer to the mark in the national interest than the partisan approach advocated by spokesmen in both political parties from time to time.
One last question before we take calls. If reelected, which committees and committee heads would you be in line for?
Oh, well, I'm on the Appropriations Committee, which is the most powerful committee probably in any government in the world, because it has all the money decisions to make. And on the Appropriations Committee, I will be the new chairman of the Department of Agriculture Appropriations. Ag, ranching, and farming is about a fourth or fifth of Wyoming's total economy. And this will be the first time in history that anybody in this area has had the chairmanship of that committee, a committee of that importance. So that will be one of the consequences. I'll be the next ranking member on the Interior Committee of Appropriations, all the monies going into the state. I will still be chairman of the Post Office and Civil Service Committee, which is a direct line from Wyoming to Washington for 5,000 federal employees, because this committee handles not only just postal affairs, but all civil service problems. It has already paid very measurable dividends for Wyoming since my years on the Post Office Civil Service Committee. Our state has received two new federal buildings, Cheyenne and Casper, as well as 23 new post offices. And it's this sort of thing that pays rich dividends to our state. Finally, on the Foreign Relations Committee, I will still be on that committee, and I'll be a unique character of sorts in that regard, in that never again is a United States Senator to be permitted to be both on the Appropriations Committee and the Foreign Relations Committee. They're the two most sought-after committees of the Senate. And in reorganizing the Senate, as we did last year, we barred any future combination of those two committees. They wanted these to go around to more senators. But those of us already on it were grandfathered in under the new legislation. So our state has a unique opportunity in that combination of committees to, in effect, in national legislation, to pack a wallop disproportionate to our rather small population, 325,000 people. Believe me, the big states not only look upon us with envy with that power that a state like Wyoming has, but some of them deeply resent it. They think they ought to have 10 senators and cut Wyoming down to one or none.
445-45, free-for-all, our lines are open, and we'll take our first call with Senator Gail McGee in just a moment. Program Free for All. Senator Gail McGee is our guest. We're set for our first call, Senator.
Good morning.
Good morning. Senator, perhaps you saw this morning when Galbraith was on television.
I didn't happen to catch that show. We've been in an airplane this morning.
Oh, well, he made the statement that traditionally the Democratic Party has stood for change. And really, the reason the Democrats are in so much trouble, really, is because we don't need two conservative parties in America. The choice is what's important to people. And I really don't see too much difference between you and Mr. Wold. It seems to me that you've come out very conservative on many things. And really, though you may not understand this, unless we do something about this war, your seniority isn't going to mean much to anyone. I have a quote here that from the paper that says, although a Democrat, McGee praised Vice President Spiro Agnew, describing him as an acute and perceptive man doing the job necessary for a good vice president. Well, I would just like to suggest to you, sir, that the real issue of this campaign should be the war, and perhaps you should be more responsive to your Democratic constituency, or the things that are really important are not going to be discussed.
I think that's those are very detailed, at least, observations. I'll try to respond to them, since there are many questions really implicit there. The first is that had you read all of the quote about Spiro Agnew that was attributed to me, it simply said that this man is not a stupid oaf, as many Democrats were contending and misleading each other about. That he is very astute, he's very smart, he's very skillful, and he knows what he's about. Spiro Agnew is taking the low road, which permits the president to take the high road, and he's doing a job that vice presidents all often have been called upon to do. And finally, in terms of the war itself, believe me, we're all as torn by the war as the next fellow. I believe that our policy that the president is pursuing now, that I support, is in fact producing disengagement. The American casualties there have dropped over half in the last year. The year before, they dropped over a third. It's really steadily unwinding and coming back to this level. And we're on the way out of there. And I think this is the only responsible way that we can get out of there without creating much greater scars. If you don't mind my finishing the statement, I thought I heard out your statement, and I'd like to finish the comment that our best chance to avoid further tragedies and worse tragedies is to disengage responsibly, and I believe that the president's policies are in truth doing that. In terms of the liberals and the conservatives, those are names that people often play games with, that what the real problem is for all of us is to try to find not the liberal answer or the conservative answer, because most of us have long since learned from our own history that the Lord didn't give all a monopoly on the right answers to the liberals or a monopoly on truth to the conservatives. It's the play between them which enables us to come up with what we hope are the wiser answers. And those of us in public office try to do that. I think that you'll find the differences among the candidates in this election for the United States Senate are very substantial differences. We happen to be very close in terms of backing the country in its policies in foreign affairs. In fact, the president, I suppose, on the conviction, really, that this ought to be above narrow partisanship. And again, there's no simple liberal or conservative answer to most of these problems. Our quest and our responsibility in public office is to try to find the right answer, if that's available to us.
Well, I would just like to suggest to you that this Vietnam invasion thing is laughable. The closest estimates are 2 years or more before we will be able to Vietnamize this. And I watched a program last night on Cambodia, and there's real question in my mind that we haven't left Cambodia in worse shape than it was in before we went into this country. And also, I can't understand why you voted against the Cooper Church Amendment. As a historian, you should recognize your Constitution and put more faith in it than you have.
Yes, that's a very good point, and that's precisely why I voted against the Cooper Church Amendment. The Cooper Church Amendment, in my judgment, was gamesmanship once more. It was simply a slap at the wrist on the president, in effect saying to the president, we don't trust you. In my interpretation of the issue there, the president of the United States was acting in that role as commander-in-chief in a conflict that, for whatever reason, however right or wrong reasons, had been underway for 5 years, and that he ought to be supported as commander-in-chief, and that it was entirely within the framework of the Constitution. I have urged Mr. Fulbright, I've written him, we've talked about it on the floor of the Senate, how important it is now that on the Foreign Relations Committee we turn without delay to updating and modernizing the role of the Congress in foreign policy in a nuclear age. We have failed to do that. And this is where the hang-ups have come. And I now have a commitment from them that we're going to do this. And I think this will reestablish the role of the Senate and the Congress in sharing the responsibility with the President in future crisis periods. But we're never going to get anywhere by raking over the old coals and trying to correct what's already history. It's already been done. We need to be ready for the next crisis in a way that is responsible, and I believe there's a real role for the Congress. I felt that Cooper Church was a spinning of wheels rather than a solving of the problem at hand.
Well, you know, Senator McGee, someone said to me the other day that they would really be happy if you would just be big enough to admit that you'd made a mistake about the war. And it seems to me you're just holding on to things that you know better. You know that you're wrong, but you just can't turn around. Now, a lot of people said they're sorry that we got into the war and they want to get out.
Yes.
But if you could just bring yourself to admit that you've been wrong, you would really, well, you'd do yourself a service. Really,
yes.
You would.
Well, no one is afraid ever to admit he's been wrong. And my misjudgment in this whole matter was over the question of whether a free society could wage a limited, undeclared war. And I have had occasion to say many times, University of Wyoming and each of the college campuses around this state, that I now have deep reservations as to whether a free society such as ours can wage an undeclared war, which I felt was a necessary requirement in a nuclear age, so you weren't nuclearizing everybody. And the point is that we've got to find a new way to rise to the meeting of crisis. Nobody's worrying about that now. We're only worrying about who to blame or who did what to whom. Larry just tells me here I ought to shift to another question, but thank you very much for taking the time. Good morning.
Good morning. Since no more effective...
No, that's okay.
Should I go ahead?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Since no more effective plot could be devised by our enemies than to keep us involved in a never-ending war in Southeast Asia, which consumes our human, economic, and material resources, and since it's generally acknowledged that Saigon regime is corrupt, and even the Green Berets don't know the good guys from the bad guys, what assurances do we have that Key and Drew are not paid by the communists to perpetuate the war?
Oh, I'm sure you don't have any assurances anyone can give except to understand the political evolution of most of those people, and that this was going on long before Karl Marx was born, before Lenin had been in Moscow, and before any other of the modern developments. I'm sure that there are some other governments of the world that are elated when we're committed in this way. The option, otherwise, as we learned in the 30s, is that once you begin to give up somebody else's real estate because it's a long way off, it leads to Mr. Hitler and Mr. Tojo in Japan. So we're still groping for some honorable way to try to head off another world holocaust, if that's possible. And I think this was one of the things that has been at stake in Eastern Asia and has already made a great difference there. But the Q and the Key regimes are a part of the Orient, a part of Asia, and they weren't invented now. They're a part of a long, long history there. We expect to make little Democrats out of them in a couple of years, and we've been working at it ourselves for 200. I think we overexpect That doesn't make it right what they do sometimes, but I think it ought to make it a little more understandable and explainable.
Well, you know, it seems that some years ago that there was an election over there, and our commitment at that time was to get out after they had their election.
Yes.
Well, they had their election, and they promptly jailed the opposition, and we're still there, and it just seems like all of those commitments are false.
Yeah, there was never any tight commitment to any kind of an election. There was the hope for free elections after the Geneva Conference in 1954. But before they could hold any elections, a fellow by the name of Ho Chi Minh seized the whole northern half of Vietnam and didn't throw into jail his opposition as they did in the south. He shot them. 42,000 of them were mowed down, the political opponents. And we sometimes leave that out. Again, it doesn't make it right to throw them into jail. I'm only saying that it's impossible to hold a free election when half of the area voting is denied the right of any choice by force of arms. So it was one of those complications, again, that reflected the immaturity in politics of Indochina. They've been too long the victims of white man's colonialism. And this is going to take a long while for them to, in my opinion, for them to mature into the art of self-government. And we may not see it in the ways we think of it in our time, but I think that still, again, remains their business. We should not try to make little Americans out of it.
Yes,
and
so many of the servicemen say that the people there couldn't care less whether they're communists or whether they're Democrats. And who are we to tell them that our way of government is better? Why shouldn't they be left alone?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And we shouldn't tell them that they have to have some special kind of government. Our only position ever has been that we didn't think that one government should be seized by some other government, by a neighbor, by force of arms. That whatever kind of government they have that works best for them, they ought to select and not have it crammed down their throats from the outside. And that applies to all the world. I think that's the central issue there.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your question. Good morning.
Good morning, Senator McGee.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to thank you for sticking to your point of view.
Well, I appreciate your mentioning that. Let me say honestly to you, I only wish I was sure I was right. I wish I was as certain I was right that there are those who are certain that I'm wrong. You can't know for sure in these times, but that's how we try to arrive at an answer, if possible.
That's true, and I personally think that Fulbright and them, those, that group is wrong, and I fully resent these lawyers and teachers and educators running over to Vietnam, making a whirlwind 3-day trip, and then coming back and set themselves up as experts
well,
in the military.
Yeah, well, you make an interesting point there. I think one of the very frightening casualties in this tortuous time over Vietnam has been the closed mind. There have been more and more people now so certain that they're right, whatever their position is, that we can't afford that kind of rigidity of the mind or of judgment. I just wish it were possible again to be that sure on anything, and I don't think the times permit it.
Well,
I wish I were sure I was right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for mentioning it.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Senator McGee, I'd just like to I'd like to mention that both me and my family are with you in your views.
Well, I appreciate your mentioning that. Again, I wish I could assure you that I was right, and I just we have grave uncertainties in this, but you can't wait until history proves you right or wrong. You've got to make your decision now as best you can.
This is true, and I'm glad that you're man enough to know that you're not always right, and I think that not everyone can be right. And so as long as you admit that you're not either wrong or right, me and my family are with you.
Well, thank you very much. Good morning, Ms. Gail McGee.
Hello, Mr. McGee. I wonder if there might be anything done about compulsory or voluntary service, and I wonder, in the Army, that is, and I wonder what your feelings are about this.
Well, we all wish there were some easier way to do it. I'm one of those that very much mistrusts a total professional Army.
Yes.
We had the experience from Prussian history over in Europe. what happens to a country when you have a very heavy-handed, heavily weighted military establishment. And one of our saving graces has been that our armies have been basically civilian armies. So I think we ought to keep that in mind. But in terms of trying to make it all equitable, I personally think we ought to establish a national service at a given age, say 19 and 20. And this would be for all men and women and everybody. No exemptions. Diabetics, the lame, the halt, the blind, the uneducated, everybody. And let them, once they're drafted for a period of 1 or 2 years for national service, to let them then be assigned to that place that best utilizes their skills. There's something everybody can do for his country. And if we would do it this way, you wouldn't find these cases of exemptions from the draft or somebody having an advantage over someone else. And I do think we ought to be looking very, very closely at a concept of national service rather than just a narrow military selective service.
Yes, this does seem like an awfully big idea.
Well, it's so big that I wish I had readier, hard answers on it. But there have to be people wise enough and smart enough to be sorting that one out and coming up with some important recommendations for it. And nobody's taken that time yet.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. McGee.
Thank you for your question.
Mm-hmm. Senator, I know you have a press conference in just a couple of minutes, so we better wrap this up so you can get over to meet the other media. We thank you for taking time and making time to be with us on Free for All this morning. I'm sure that some future date we'll have the opportunity, we hope, to have you back and discuss the issues and let you talk with our listeners, the citizens of Casper.
I want to thank you again, Larry, for making this possible this morning, and I want to thank those who called in for the really very meaningful comments or points of view and suggestions. But I would say to each of them again, let's just exercise the precaution of not closing our minds and being absolutely certain that I'm right and you're wrong. I think we've got to keep the open mind if we're to keep a free society strong.
One last question, Senator, before we end the program. There are many people that I'm sure would like to correspond with you some way, and besides trying to write down a lengthy address in Washington, D.C. to you, is there some way they can get in touch with you through representatives in Wyoming?
Oh, yes. If they would just write to Senator McGee, Casper, Wyoming. That's all it takes. You don't have to have more specifics. Or if you want to write to Washington, Senator McGee, Washington, D.C. It doesn't take any more than that, and they'll get here. Dick Brown is the chief of my offices here in Wyoming, an office in the federal building in Cheyenne, and my office here on North Center Street in Casper. And any messages directed only with that very general definition on it, Senator McGee, Casper, Wyoming, or Senator McGee, Washington, D.C., will reach me, and we appreciate your writing, your questions, or sending along your advice. I'm interested in what you have to say.
Senator McGee, thank you again for being on Free for All today.
Thanks again, Larry.
Senator Gail McGee, United States Senator from Wyoming, in the Democratic primary coming up, of course, with a primary on the Democratic ticket, August the 18th. Thank you again, Senator, and good morning, everyone. We'll see you Monday morning on Free for All with George Grierson talking about Save the Children Federation.
Join us each weekday morning for Free for All. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KATI, its ownership, management, employees, or sponsors.